and chemical stimulation. If they did not respond, he would radio Earth for further orders. And then, if there was no reply from Earth, he would take what measures he deemed necessary to safeguard the ship and to continue the mission, whose real purpose he alone knew, and which his human colleagues could never have guessed. Poole and Bowman had often humorously referred to themselves as caretakers or janitors aboard a ship that could really run itself. They would have been astonished and more than a little indignant to discover how much truth that jest contained. Chapter 17. Cruise Mode. The day-by-day running of the ship had been planned with great care, and, theoretically at least, Bowman and Poole knew what they would be doing at every moment of the 24 hours. They operated on a 12-hours-on, 12-hours-off basis, taking charge alternately and never being both asleep at the same time. The officer on duty remained on the control deck while his deputies saw to the general housekeeping, inspected the ship, coped with the odd jobs that constantly arose, or relaxed in his cubicle. Although Bowman was nominal captain on this phase of the mission, no outside observer could have deduced the fact. He and Poole switched roles, rank, and responsibilities completely every 12 hours. This kept them both at peak training, minimized the chances of friction, and helped toward the goal of 100% redundancy. Bowman's day began at 0600 ship's time, the universal ephemeris time of the astronomers. If he was late, Hal had a variety of beeps and chimes to remind him of his duty, but they had never been used. As a test, Poole had once switched off the alarm. Bowman had still risen automatically at the right time. His first official act of the day would be to advance the master hibernation timer 12 hours. If this operation was missed twice in a row, Hal would assume that both he and Poole had been incapacitated and would take the necessary emergency action. Bowman would attend to his toilet and do his isometric exercises before settling down to breakfast and the morning's radio fax edition of the World Times. On Earth, he never read the paper as carefully as he did now. Even the smallest items of society gossip, the most fleeting political rumors, seemed of absorbing interest as they flashed across the screen. At 0700, he would officially relieve Poole on the control deck, bringing him a squeeze tube of coffee from the kitchen. If, as was usually the case, there was nothing to report and no action to be taken, he would settle down to check all the instrument readings and would run through a series of tests designed to spot possible malfunctions. By 1000, this would be finished, and he would start on a study period. Bowman had been a student for more than half his life. He would continue to be one until he retired. Thanks to the 20th century revolutions in training and information handling techniques, he already possessed the equivalent of 2 or 3 college educations, and what was more, he could remember 90% of what he had learned. 50 years ago, he would have been considered a specialist in applied astronomy, cybernetics, and space propulsion systems, yet he was prone to deny with genuine indignation that he was a specialist at all. Bowman had never found it possible to focus his interest exclusively on any subject, despite the dark warnings of his instructors. He had insisted on taking his master's degree in general astronautics, a course with a vague and woolly syllabus designed for those whose IQs were in the low 130s and who would never reach the top ranks of their profession. His decision had been right. That very refusal to specialize had made him uniquely qualified for his present task. In much the same way, Frank Poole, who sometimes disparagingly called himself general practitioner in space biology, had been an ideal choice as his deputy. The two of them, with, if necessary, help from Hal's vast stores of information, could cope with any problems likely to arise during the voyage, as long as they kept their minds alert and receptive and continually re-engraved old patterns of memory. So for 2 hours, from 1000 to 1200, Bowman would engage in a dialogue with an electronic tutor, checking his general knowledge or absorbing material specific to this mission. He would prowl endlessly over ship's plans, circuit diagrams, and voyage profiles, or would try to assimilate all that was known about Jupiter, Saturn, and their far-ranging families of moons. At midday, he would retire to the galley and leave the ship to Hal while he prepared his lunch. Even here, he was still fully in touch with events, for the tiny lounge-cum-dining room contained a duplicate of the situation display panel, and Hal could call him at a moment's notice. Poole would join him for this meal, before retiring for his 6-hour sleep period, and usually they would watch one of the regular TV programs beamed to them from Earth. Their menus had been planned with as much care as any part of the mission. The food, most of it freeze-dried, was uniformly excellent and had been chosen for the minimum of trouble. Packets had merely to be opened and popped into the tiny auto galley, which beeped for attention when the job was done. They could enjoy what tasted like, and equally important, looked like, orange juice, eggs, any style, steaks, chops, roasts, fresh vegetables, assorted fruits, ice cream, and even freshly baked bread. After lunch, from 1300 to 1600, Bowman would make a slow and careful tour of the ship, or such part of it as was accessible. Discovery measured almost 400 feet from end to end, but the little universe occupied by her crew lay entirely inside the 40-foot sphere of the pressure hull. Here were all the life support systems, and the control deck, which was the operational heart of the ship. Below this was a small space garage, fitted with 3 airlocks, through which powered capsules, just large enough to hold a man, could sail out into the void if the need arose for extra vehicular activity. The equatorial region of the pressure sphere, the slice, as it were, from Capricorn to Cancer, enclosed a slowly rotating drum, 35 feet in diameter. As it made one revolution every 10 seconds, this carousel, or centrifuge, produced an artificial gravity equal to that of the Moon. This was enough to prevent the physical atrophy which would result from the complete absence of weight, and it also allowed the routine functions of living to be carried out under normal, or nearly normal, conditions. The carousel, therefore, contained the kitchen, dining, washing, and toilet facilities. Only here was it safe to prepare and handle hot drinks, quite dangerous in weightless conditions, where one can be badly scalded by floating globules of boiling water. The problem of shaving was also solved. There would be no weightless bristles drifting around to endanger electrical equipment and produce a health hazard. Around the rim of the carousel were 5 tiny cubicles, fitted out by each astronaut according to taste and containing his personal belongings. Only Bowman's and Poole's were now in use, while the future occupants of the other 3 cabins reposed in their electronic sarcophagi next door. The spin of the carousel could be stopped if necessary. When this happened, its angular momentum had to be stored in a flywheel and switched back again when rotation was restarted. But normally it was left running at constant speed, for it was easy enough to enter the big, slowly turning drum by going hand over hand along a pole through the zero-G region at its center. Transferring to the moving section was as easy and automatic, after a little experience, as stepping onto a moving escalator. The spherical pressure hull formed the head of a flimsy, arrow-shaped structure more than 100 yards long. Discovery, like all vehicles intended for deep space penetration, was too fragile and unstreamlined ever to enter an atmosphere, or to defy the full gravitational field of any planet. She had been assembled in orbit around the Earth, tested on a translunar maiden flight, and finally checked out in orbit above the Moon. She was a creature of pure space, and she looked it. Immediately behind the pressure hull was grouped a cluster of 4 large liquid hydrogen tanks, and beyond them, forming a long, slender V, were the radiating fins that dissipated the waste heat of the nuclear reactor. Veined with a delicate tracery of pipes for the cooling fluid, they looked like the wings of some vast dragonfly, and from certain angles gave Discovery a fleeting resemblance to an old-time sailing ship. At the very end of the V, 300 feet from the crew compartment, was the shielded inferno of the reactor, and the complex of focusing electrodes through which emerged the incandescent star stuff of the plasma drive. This had done its work weeks ago, forcing Discovery out of her parking orbit round the Moon. Now the reactor was merely ticking over as it generated electrical power for the ship's service, and the great radiating fins, that would glow cherry red when Discovery was accelerating under maximum thrust, were dark and cool. Although it would require an excursion out into space to examine this region of the ship, there were instruments and remote TV cameras which gave a full report on conditions here. Bowman now felt that he knew intimately every square foot of the radiator, panels, and every piece of plumbing associated with them. By 1600, he would have finished his inspection and would make a detailed verbal report to Mission Control, talking until the acknowledgments started to come in. Then he would switch off his own transmitter, listen to what Earth had to say, and send back his reply to any queries. At 1800 hours, Poole would awaken, and he would hand over command. He would have 6 off-duty hours to use as he pleased. Sometimes he would continue his studies, or listen to music, or look at movies. Much of the time he would wander at will through the ship's inexhaustible electronic library. He had become fascinated by the great explorations of the past, understandably enough in the circumstances. Sometimes he would cruise with Pythias out through the Pillars of Hercules, along the coast of a Europe barely emerging from the Stone Age, and venture almost to the chill mists of the Arctic. Or, 2,000 years later, he would pursue the Manila galleons with Anson, sail with Cook along the unknown hazards of the Great Barrier Reef, achieve with Magellan the first circumnavigation of the world. And he began to read the Odyssey, which of all books spoke to him most vividly across the gulfs of time. For relaxation, he could always engage Hal in a large number of semi-mathematical games, including checkers, chess, and polyominoes. If Hal went all out, he could win any of them, but that would be bad for morale. So he had been programmed to win only 50% of the time, and his human partners pretended not to know this. The last hours of Bowman's day were devoted to general cleaning up and odd jobs, followed by dinner at 2000, again with Poole. Then there would be an hour during which he would make or receive any personal call from Earth. Like all his colleagues, Bowman was unmarried. It was not fair to send family men on a mission of such duration. Though numerous ladies had promised to wait until the expedition returned, no one had really believed this. At first, both Poole and Bowman had been making rather intimate personal calls once a week, though the knowledge that many ears must be listening at the Earth end of the circuit tended to inhibit them. Yet already, though the voyage was scarcely started, the warmth and frequency of the conversations with their girls on Earth had begun to diminish. They had expected this. It was one of the penalties of an astronaut's way of life, as it had once been of a mariner's. It was true, indeed notorious, that seamen had compensations at other ports. Unfortunately, there were no tropical islands full of dusky maids beyond the orbit of Earth. The space medics, of course, had tackled this problem with their usual enthusiasm. The ship's pharmacopoeia provided adequate, though hardly glamorous, substitutes. Just before he signed off, Bowman would make his final report and check that Hal had transmitted all the instrumentation tapes for the day's run. Then, if he felt like it, he would spend a couple of hours either reading or looking at a movie, and at midnight he would go to sleep, usually without any help from electronarcosis. Poole's program was a mirror image of his own, and the two schedules dovetailed together without friction. Both men were fully occupied. They were too intelligent and well-adjusted to quarrel, and the voyage had settled down to a comfortable, utterly uneventful routine, the passage of time marked only by the changing numbers on the digital clocks. The greatest hope of Discovery's little crew was that nothing would mar this peaceful monotony in the weeks and months that lay ahead. Chapter 18. Through the Asteroids. Week after week, running like a streetcar along the tracks of her utterly predetermined orbit, Discovery swept past the orbit of Mars and on toward Jupiter. Unlike all the vessels traversing the skies or seas of Earth, she required not even the most minute touch on the controls. Her course was fixed by the laws of gravitation. There were no uncharted shoals, no dangerous reefs on which she would run aground. Nor was there the slightest danger of collision with another ship, for there was no vessel, at least of man's making, anywhere between her and the infinitely distant stars. Yet the space which she was now entering was far from empty. Ahead lay a no-man's land threaded by the paths of more than 1,000,000 asteroids, less than 10,000 of which had ever had their orbits precisely determined by astronomers. Only 4 were over 100 miles in diameter. The vast majority were merely giant boulders trundling aimlessly through space. There was nothing that could be done about them, though even the smallest could completely destroy the ship if it slammed into it at tens of thousands of miles an hour. The chance of this happening was negligible. On the average, there was only one asteroid in a volume a million miles on a side. That discovery should also happen to occupy this same point and at the same time was the very least of the crew's worries. On day 86, they were due to make their closest approach to any known asteroid. It had no name, merely the number 7794, and was a 50-yard diameter rock that had been detected by the Lunar Observatory in 1997 and immediately forgotten except by the patient computers of the Minor Planet Bureau. When Bowman came on duty, Hal promptly reminded him of the forthcoming encounter. Not that he was likely to have forgotten the only scheduled in-flight event of the entire voyage. The track of the asteroid against the stars and its coordinates at the moment of closest approach had already been printed out on the display screens. Listed also were the observations to be made or attempted. They were going to be very busy when 7794 flashed past them only 900 miles away at a relative speed of 80,000 miles an hour. When Bowman asked Hal for the telescopic display, a sparsely sprinkled star field flashed onto the screen. There was nothing that looked like an asteroid. All the images, even under the highest magnification, were dimensionless points of light. "Give me the target reticule," asked Bowman. Immediately, four faint, narrow lines appeared, bracketing a tiny and undistinguished star. He stared at it for many minutes, wondering if Hal could possibly be mistaken. Then he saw that the pinpoint of light was moving, with barely perceptible slowness, against the background of the stars. It might still be half a million miles away, but its movement proved that, as cosmic distances went, it was almost near enough to touch. When Poole joined him on the control deck 6 hours later, 7794 was hundreds of times more brilliant and was moving so swiftly against its background that there was no question of its identity. And it was no longer a point of light. It had begun to show a clearly visible disk. They stared at that passing pebble in the sky with the emotions of sailors on a long sea voyage skirting a coast on which they cannot land. Though they were perfectly well aware that 7794 was only a lifeless, airless chunk of rock, this knowledge scarcely affected their feelings. It was the only solid matter they would meet this side of Jupiter. Still, 200 million miles away. Through the high-powered telescope, they could see that the asteroid was very irregular and turning slowly end over end. Sometimes it looked like a flattened sphere, sometimes it resembled a roughly shaped brick. Its rotation period was just over 2 minutes. There were mottled patches of light and shade distributed apparently at random over its surface, and often it sparkled like a distant window, as planes or outcroppings of crystalline material flashed in the sun. It was racing past them at almost 30 miles a second. They had only a few frantic minutes in which to observe it closely. The automatic cameras took dozens of photographs, the navigation radar's returning echoes were carefully recorded for future analysis, and there was just time for a single impact probe. The probe carried no instruments. None could survive a collision at such cosmic speeds. It was merely a small slug of metal, shot out from Discovery on a course which should intersect that of the asteroid. As the seconds before impact ticked away, Poole and Bowman waited with mounting tension. The experiment, simple though it was in principle, taxed the accuracy of their equipment to the limits. They were aiming at a 100-foot diameter target from a distance of thousands of miles. Against the darkened portion of the asteroid, there was a sudden, dazzling explosion of light. The tiny slug had impacted at meteoric speed. In a fraction of a second, all its energy had been transformed into heat. A puff of incandescent gas had erupted briefly into space. Aboard Discovery, the cameras were recording the rapidly fading spectral lines. Back on Earth, experts would analyze them, looking for the telltale signatures of glowing atoms, and so, for the first time, the composition of an asteroid's crust would be determined. Within an hour, 7794 was a dwindling star, showing no trace of a disk. When Bowman next came on watch, it had vanished completely. They were alone again. They would remain alone, until the outermost of Jupiter's moons came swimming up toward them, 3 months from now. Chapter 19. Transit of Jupiter. Even from 20 million miles away, Jupiter was already the most conspicuous object in the sky ahead. The planet was now a pale, salmon-hued disk, about half the size of the moon as seen from Earth, with the dark, parallel bands of its cloud belts clearly visible. Shuttling back and forth in the equatorial plane were the brilliant stars of Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto, worlds that elsewhere would have counted as planets in their own right, but which here were merely satellites of a giant master. Through the telescope, Jupiter was a glorious sight, a mottled, multicolored globe that seemed to fill the sky. It was impossible to grasp its real size. Bowman kept reminding himself that it was 11 times the diameter of Earth, but for a long time this was a statistic with no real meaning. Then, while he was briefing himself from the tapes in Hal's memory units, he found something that suddenly brought the appalling scale of the planet into focus. It was an illustration that showed the Earth's entire surface peeled off and then pegged, like the skin of an animal, on the disk of Jupiter. Against this background, all the continents and oceans of Earth appeared no larger than India on the terrestrial globe. When Bowman used the highest magnification of Discovery's telescopes, he appeared to be hanging above a slightly flattened globe, looking down upon a vista of racing clouds that had been smeared into bands by the giant world's swift rotation. Sometimes those bands congealed into wisps and knots and continent-sized masses of colored vapor. Sometimes they were linked by transient bridges thousands of miles in length. Hidden beneath those clouds was enough material to outweigh all the other planets in the solar system. And what else, Bowman wondered, was also hidden there? Over this shifting, turbulent roof of clouds, forever hiding the real surface of the planet, circular patterns of darkness sometimes glided. One of the inner moons was transiting the distant sun, its shadow marching beneath it over the restless Jovian cloudscape. There were other and far smaller moons even out here, 20 million miles from Jupiter. But they were only flying mountains, a few dozen miles in diameter, and the ship would pass nowhere near any of them. Every few minutes, the radar transmitter would gather its strength and send out a silent thunderclap of power. No echoes of new satellites came pulsing back from the emptiness. What did come, with ever-growing intensity, was the roar of Jupiter's own radio voice. In 1955, just before the dawn of the space age, astronomers had been astonished to find that Jupiter was blasting out millions of horsepower on the 10-meter band. It was merely raw noise, associated with halos of charged particles circling the planet like the Van Allen belts of Earth, but on a far greater scale. Sometimes, during lonely hours on the control deck, Bowman would listen to this radiation. He would turn up the gain until the room filled with a crackling, hissing roar. Out of this background, at irregular intervals, emerged brief whistles and peeps, like the cries of demented birds. It was an eerie sound, for it had nothing to do with man. It was as lonely and as meaningless as the murmur of waves on a beach, or the distant crash of thunder beyond the horizon. Even at her present speed of over 100,000 miles an hour, it would take Discovery almost 2 weeks to cross the orbits of all the Jovian satellites. More moons circled Jupiter than planets orbited the sun. The Lunar Observatory was discovering new ones every year, and the tally had now reached 36. The outermost, Jupiter 27, moved backwards in an unstable path 19 million miles from its temporary master. It was the prize in a perpetual tug-of-war between Jupiter and the sun, for the planet was constantly capturing short-lived moons from the asteroid belt and losing them again after a few million years. Only the inner satellites were its permanent property. The sun could never wrest them from its grasp. Now there was new prey for the clashing gravitational fields. Discovery was accelerating toward Jupiter along a complex orbit computed months ago by the astronomers on Earth and constantly checked by Hal. From time to time there would be minute, automatic nudges from the control jets, scarcely perceptible aboard the ship as they made fine adjustments to the trajectory. Over the radio link with Earth, information was flowing back in a constant stream. They were now so far from home that, even traveling at the speed of light, their signals were taking 50 minutes for the journey. Though the whole world was looking over their shoulders, watching through their eyes and their instruments as Jupiter approached, it would be almost an hour before the news of their discoveries reached home. The telescopic cameras were operating constantly as the ship cut across the orbit of the giant inner satellites, every one of them larger than the moon, every one of them unknown territory. 3 hours before transit, Discovery passed only 20,000 miles from Europa, and all instruments were aimed at the approaching world as it grew steadily in size, changed from globe to crescent, and swept swiftly sunward. Here were 14 million square miles of land, which, until this moment, had never been more than a pinhead in the mightiest telescope. They would race past it in minutes and must make the most of the encounter, recording all the information they could. There would be months in which they could play it back at leisure. From a distance, Europa had seemed like a giant snowball, reflecting the light of the far-off sun with remarkable efficiency. Closer observations confirmed this. Unlike the dusty moon, Europa was a brilliant white, and much of its surface was covered with glittering hunks that looked like stranded icebergs. Almost certainly, these were formed from ammonia and water that Jupiter's gravitational field had somehow failed to capture. Only along the equator was bare rock visible. Here was an incredibly jagged no-man's land of canyons and jumbled boulders, forming a darker band that completely surrounded the little world. There were a few impact craters, but no sign of volcanism. Europa had obviously never possessed any internal sources of heat. There was, as had long been known, a trace of atmosphere. When the dark edge of the satellite passed across a star, it dimmed briefly before the moment of eclipse, and in some areas there was a hint of cloud, perhaps a mist of ammonia droplets borne on tenuous methane winds. As swiftly as it had rushed out of the sky ahead, Europa dropped astern, and now Jupiter itself was only 2 hours away. Hal had checked and rechecked the ship's orbit with infinite care, and there was no need for further speed corrections until the moment of closest approach. Yet even knowing this, it was a strain on the nerves to watch that giant globe ballooning minute by minute. It was difficult to believe that Discovery was not plunging directly into it, and that the planet's immense gravitational field was not dragging them down to destruction. Now was the time to drop the atmospheric probes, which, it was hoped, would survive long enough to send back some information from below the Jovian cloud deck. Two stubby, bomb-shaped capsules, enclosed in ablative heat shields, were gently nudged into orbits which, for the first few thousand miles, deviated scarcely at all from that of Discovery. But they slowly drifted away, and now, at last, even the unaided eye could see what Hal had been asserting. The ship was in a near-grazing orbit, not a collision one. She would miss the atmosphere. True, the difference was only a few hundred miles, a mere nothing when one was dealing with a planet 90,000 miles in diameter, but that was enough. Jupiter now filled the entire sky. It was so huge that neither mind nor eye could grasp it any longer, and both had abandoned the attempt. If it had not been for the extraordinary variety of color, the reds and pinks and yellows and salmons and even scarlets of the atmosphere beneath them, Bowman could have believed that he was flying low over a cloudscape on Earth. And now, for the first time in all their journeying, they were about to lose the sun. Pale and shrunken though it was, it had been Discovery's constant companion since her departure from Earth 5 months ago, but now her orbit was diving into the shadow of Jupiter. She would soon pass over the night side of the planet. 1,000 miles ahead, the band of twilight was hurtling toward them. Behind, the sun was sinking swiftly into the Jovian clouds. Its rays spread out along the horizon like two flaming, downturned horns, then contracted and died in a brief blaze of chromatic glory. The night had come. And yet, the great world below was not wholly dark. It was awash with phosphorescence, which grew brighter minute by minute as their eyes grew accustomed to the scene. Dim rivers of light were flowing from horizon to horizon, like the luminous wakes of ships on some tropical sea. Here and there they gathered into pools of liquid fire, trembling with vast submarine disturbances welling up from the hidden heart of Jupiter. It was a sight so awe-inspiring that Poole and Bowman could have stared for hours. Was this, they wondered, merely the result of chemical and electrical forces down there in that seething cauldron, or was it the byproduct of some fantastic form of life? These were questions which scientists might still be debating when the newborn century drew to its close. As they drove deeper and deeper into the Jovian night, the glow beneath them grew steadily brighter. Once Bowman had flown over northern Canada during the height of an auroral display. The snow-covered landscape had been as bleak and brilliant as this. And that Arctic wilderness, he reminded himself, was more than 100 degrees warmer than the regions over which they were hurtling now.
"Earth signal is fading rapidly," announced Hal. "We are entering the first diffraction zone."
They had expected this. Indeed, it was one of the mission's objectives, as the absorption of radio waves would give valuable information about the Jovian atmosphere. But now that they had actually passed behind the planet, and it was cutting off communication with Earth, they felt a sudden, overwhelming loneliness. The radio blackout would last only an hour. Then they would emerge from Jupiter's eclipsing screen and could resume contact with the human race. That hour, however, would be one of the longest of their lives. Despite their relative youth, Poole and Bowman were veterans of a dozen space voyages, but now they felt like novices. They were attempting something for the first time. Never before had any ship traveled at such speeds or braved so intense a gravitational field. The slightest error in navigation at this critical point, and Discovery would go speeding on toward the far limits of the solar system, beyond any hope of rescue. The slow minutes dragged by. Jupiter was now a vertical wall of phosphorescence stretching to infinity above them, and the ship was climbing straight up its glowing face. Though they knew that they were moving far too swiftly for even Jupiter's gravity to capture them, it was hard to believe that Discovery had not become a satellite of this monstrous world. At last, far ahead, there was a blaze of light along the horizon. They were emerging from shadow, heading out into the sun, and at almost the same moment, Hal announced,
"I am in radio contact with Earth. I am also happy to say that the perturbation maneuver has been successfully completed. Our time to Saturn is 167 days, 5 hours, 11 minutes.
That was within a minute of the estimate. The flyby had been carried out with impeccable precision. Like a ball on a cosmic pool table, Discovery had bounced off the moving gravitational field of Jupiter and had gained momentum from the impact. Without using any fuel, she had increased her speed by several thousand miles an hour. Yet, there was no violation of the laws of mechanics. Nature always balances her books, and Jupiter had lost exactly as much momentum as Discovery had gained. The planet had been slowed down, but as its mass was a sextillion times greater than the ship's, the change in its orbit was far too small to be detectable. The time had not yet come when man could leave his mark upon the solar system. As the light grew swiftly around them, and the shrunken sun lifted once more into the Jovian sky, Poole and Bowman reached out silently and shook each other's hands. Though they could hardly believe it, the first part of the mission was safely over. Chapter 20. The World of the Gods. But they had not yet finished with Jupiter. Far behind, the two probes that Discovery had launched were making contact with the atmosphere. One was never heard from again. Presumably, it made too steep an entry and burned up before it could send any information. The second was more successful. It sliced through the upper layers of the Jovian atmosphere, then skimmed out once more into space. As had been planned, it had lost so much speed by the encounter that it fell back again along a great ellipse. 2 hours later, it re-entered atmosphere on the daylight side of the planet, moving at 70,000 miles an hour. Immediately, it was wrapped in an envelope of incandescent gas, and radio contact was lost. There were anxious minutes of waiting, then, for the two watchers on the control deck. They could not be certain that the probe would survive, and that the protective ceramic shield would not burn completely away before braking had finished. If that happened, the instruments would be vaporized in a fraction of a second. But the shield held long enough for the glowing meteor to come to rest. The charred fragments were jettisoned, the robot thrust out its antennas and began to peer around with its electronic senses. Aboard Discovery, now almost a quarter of a million miles away, the radio started to bring in the first authentic news from Jupiter. The thousands of pulses pouring in every second were reporting atmospheric composition, pressure, temperature, magnetic fields, radioactivity, and dozens of other factors which only the experts on Earth could unravel. However, there was one message that could be understood instantly. It was the TV picture, in full color, sent back by the falling probe. The first views came when the robot had already entered the atmosphere and had discarded its protective shell. All that was visible was a yellow mist, flecked with patches of scarlet, which moved past the camera at a dizzying rate, streaming upwards as the probe fell at several hundred miles an hour. The mist grew thicker. It was impossible to guess whether the camera was seeing for 10 inches or 10 miles because there were no details on which the eye could focus. It seemed that, as far as the TV system was concerned, the mission was a failure. The equipment had worked, but there was nothing to see in this foggy, turbulent atmosphere. And then, quite abruptly, the mist vanished. The probe must have fallen through the base of a high layer of cloud and come out into a clear zone, perhaps a region of almost pure hydrogen with only a sparse scattering of ammonia crystals. Though it was still quite impossible to judge the scale of the picture, the camera was obviously seeing for miles. The scene was so alien that for a moment it was almost meaningless to eyes accustomed to the colors and shapes of Earth. Far, far below lay an endless sea of mottled gold, scarred with parallel ridges that might have been the crests of gigantic waves. But there was no movement. The scale of the scene was too immense to show it, and that golden vista could not possibly have been an ocean, for it was still high in the Jovian atmosphere. It could only have been another layer of cloud. Then the camera caught, tantalizingly blurred by distance, a glimpse of something very strange. Many miles away, the golden landscape reared itself into a curiously symmetrical cone, like a volcanic mountain.
This is the end of Disc 3. Please continue listening on Disc number 4. This is Disc number 4.
The camera caught, tantalizingly blurred by distance, a glimpse of something very strange. Many miles away, the golden landscape reared itself into a curiously symmetrical cone, like a volcanic mountain. Around the summit of that cone was a halo of small, puffy clouds, all about the same size, all quite distinct and isolated. There was something disturbing and unnatural about them, if indeed the word natural could ever be applied to this awesome panorama. Then, caught by some turbulence in the rapidly thickening atmosphere, the probe twisted around to another quarter of the horizon, and for a few seconds the screen showed nothing but a golden blur. Presently it stabilized. The sea was much closer, but as enigmatic as ever. One could now observe that it was interrupted here and there with patches of darkness, which might have been holes or gaps leading to still deeper layers of the atmosphere. The probe was destined never to reach them. Every mile, the density of the gas around it had been doubling, the pressure mounting as it sank deeper and deeper toward the hidden surface of the planet. It was still high above that mysterious sea when the picture gave one premonitory flicker, then vanished, as the first explorer from Earth crumpled beneath the weight of the miles of atmosphere above it. It had given, in its brief life, a glimpse of perhaps 1/1,000,000th of Jupiter, and had barely approached the planet's surface hundreds of miles down in the deepening mists. When the picture faded from the screen, Bowman and Poole could only sit in silence, turning the same thought over in their minds. The ancients had indeed done better than they knew when they named this world after the Lord of all the gods. If there was life down there, how long would it take even to locate it? And after that, how many centuries before men could follow this first pioneer? In what kind of ship? But these matters were now no concern of Discovery and her crew. Their goal was a still stranger world, almost twice as far from the sun, across another 500,000,000 miles of comet-haunted emptiness. Part 4. Abyss. Chapter 21. Birthday Party. The familiar strains of Happy Birthday hurled across 700,000,000 miles of space at the velocity of light died away among the vision screens and instrumentation of the control desk. The Poole family, grouped rather self-consciously round the birthday cake on Earth, lapsed into a sudden silence. Then Mr. Poole Sr. said gruffly,
"Well, Frank, I can't think of anything else to say at the moment, except that our thoughts are with you, and we're wishing you the happiest of birthdays."
"Take care, darling," Mrs. Poole interjected tearfully. "God bless you."
There was a chorus of goodbyes, and the vision screen went blank. How strange to think, Poole told himself, that all this had happened more than an hour ago. By now, his family would have dispersed again, and its members would be miles from home. But in a way, that time lag, though it could be frustrating, was also a blessing in disguise. Like every man of his age, Poole took it for granted that he could talk instantly to anyone on Earth whenever he pleased. Now that this was no longer true, the psychological impact was profound. He had moved into a new dimension of remoteness, and almost all emotional links had been stretched beyond the yield point.
"Sorry to interrupt the festivities," said Hal, "but we have a problem."
"What is it?" Bowman and Poole asked simultaneously.
"I am having difficulty in maintaining contact with Earth. The trouble is in the AE-35 unit. My fault prediction center reports that it may fail within 72 hours.
"We'll take care of it," Bowman replied. "Let's see the optical alignment."
"Here it is, Dave. It's still okay at the moment."
On the display screen appeared a perfect half-moon, very brilliant against a background almost free of stars. It was covered with clouds and showed not one geographical feature that could be recognized. Indeed, at first glance, it could be easily mistaken for Venus. But not at a second one, for there beside it was the real moon, which Venus did not possess, a quarter the size of Earth and in exactly the same phase. It was easy to imagine that the two bodies were mother and child, as many astronomers had believed, before the evidence of the lunar rocks had proved beyond doubt that the moon had never been part of Earth. Poole and Bowman studied the screen in silence for half a minute. This image was coming to them from the long-focused TV camera mounted on the rim of the big radio dish. The cross wires at its center showed the exact orientation of the antenna. Unless the narrow pencil beam was pointed precisely at Earth, they could neither receive nor transmit. Messages in both directions would miss their target and would shoot, unheard and unseen, out through the solar system and into the emptiness beyond. If they were ever received, it would not be for centuries, and not by men.
"Do you know where the trouble is?" asked Bowman.
"It's intermittent, and I can't localize it, but it appears to be in the AE-35 unit."
"What procedure do you suggest?"
"The best thing would be to replace the unit with a spare, so that we can check it over."
"Okay, let us have the hard copy."
The information flashed on the display screen. Simultaneously, a sheet of paper slid out of the slot immediately beneath it. Despite all the electronic readouts, there are times when good old-fashioned printed material was the most convenient form of record. Bowman studied the diagrams for a moment, then whistled.
You might have told us. This means going outside the ship.
I'm sorry. I assumed you knew that the AE-35 unit was on the antenna mounting.
I probably did a year ago, but there are 8,000 subsystems aboard. Anyway, it looks like a straightforward job. We only have to unlock a panel and put in a new unit.
That suits me fine,
said Poole, who was the crew member designated for routine extravehicular activity.
I could do with a change of scenery. Nothing personal, of course.
Let's see if Mission Control agrees, said Bowman. He sat still for a few seconds, marshaling his thoughts, then started to dictate a message.
Mission Control, this is X-Ray Delta 1. At 2045, onboard fault prediction center in our Niner 000 computer showed Alpha Echo 3-5 unit as probable failure within 72 hours. Request check your telemetry monitoring and suggest you review unit in your ship systems simulator. Also, confirm your approval our plan to go EVA and replace Alpha Echo 3-5 unit prior to failure. Mission Control, this is X-Ray Delta 1, 2103, transmission concluded.
Through years of practice, Bowman could switch at a moment's notice to this jargon, which someone had once christened technish, and back again to normal speech without clashing his mental gears. Now there was nothing to do but to wait for the confirmation, which would take at least 2 hours as the signals made the round trip past the orbits of Jupiter and Mars. It came while Bowman was trying, without much success, to beat Hal at one of the geometrical pattern games stored in his memory.
X-Ray Delta 1, this is Mission Control acknowledging your 2103. We are reviewing telemetric information on your mission simulator and will advise. Roger, your plan to go EVA and replace Alpha Echo 3-5 unit prior to possible failure. We are working on test procedures for you to apply to faulty unit.
The serious business having been completed, the mission controller reverted to normal English.
Sorry you fellows are having a bit of trouble, and we don't want to add to your woes, but if it's convenient to you prior to EVA, we have a request from public information. Could you do a brief recording for general release, outlining the situation and explaining just what the AE-35 does? Make it as reassuring as you can. We could do it, of course, but it will be much more convincing in your words. Hope this won't interfere too badly with your social life. X-Ray Delta 1, this is Mission Control, 2155, transmission concluded.
Bowman could not help smiling at the request. There were times when Earth showed a curious insensitivity and lack of tact.
Make it reassuring, indeed.
When Poole joined him at the end of his sleep period, they spent 10 minutes composing and polishing the reply. In the early stages of the mission, there had been countless requests from all the news media for interviews, discussions, almost anything that they cared to say. But as the weeks drifted uneventfully past, and the time lag increased from a few minutes to over an hour, interest had gradually slackened. Since the excitement of the Jupiter flyby over a month ago, they had made only 3 or 4 tapes for general release.
Mission Control, this is X-Ray Delta 1. Here's your press statement.
Earlier today, a minor technical problem occurred. Our HAL 9000 computer predicted the failure of the AE-35 unit. This is a small but vital component of the communication system. It keeps our main antenna aimed at Earth to within a few thousandths of a degree. This accuracy is required, since at our present distance of more than 700 million miles, Earth is only a rather faint star, and our very narrow radio beam could easily miss it. The antenna is kept constantly tracking Earth by motors controlled from the central computer, but those motors get their instructions via the AE-35 unit. You might compare it to a nerve center in the body, which translates the brain's instructions to the muscles of a limb. If the nerve fails to pass on the correct signals, the limb becomes useless. In our case, a breakdown of the AE-35 unit could mean that the antenna will start pointing at random. This was a common trouble with the deep space probes of the last century. They often reached other planets, then failed to send back any information because their antenna couldn't locate Earth. We don't know the nature of the fault yet, but the situation is not at all serious and there is no need for alarm. We have two backup AE-35s, each of which has an operational life expectancy of 20 years, so the chance that a second will fail during the course of this mission is negligible. Also, if we can diagnose the present trouble, we may be able to repair the number one unit. Frank Poole, who is specially qualified for this type of work, will go outside the ship and replace the faulty unit with the backup. At the same time, he'll take the opportunity of checking the hull and repairing some micropunctures that have been too small to merit a special EVA. Apart from this minor problem, the mission is still going uneventfully and should continue in the same manner. Mission Control, this is X-ray Delta 12104, transmission concluded. Chapter 22, Excursion. Discovery's extravehicular capsules, or space pods, were spheres about 9 feet in diameter, and the operator sat behind a bay window which gave him a splendid view. The main rocket drive produced an acceleration of 1/5 of a gravity, just sufficient to hover on the moon, while small attitude control nozzles allowed for steering. From an area immediately beneath the bay window sprouted two sets of articulated metal arms, or Waldos, one for heavy duty, the other for delicate manipulation. There was also an extensible turret carrying a variety of power tools, such as screwdrivers, jackhammers, saws, and drills. Space pods were not the most elegant means of transport devised by man, but they were absolutely essential for construction and maintenance work in vacuum. They were usually christened with feminine names, perhaps in recognition of the fact that their personalities were sometimes slightly unpredictable. Discovery's trio were Anna, Betty, and Clara. Once he had put on his personal pressure suit, his last line of defense, and climbed inside the pod, Poole spent 10 minutes carefully checking the controls. He burped the steering jets, flexed the Waldos, reconfirmed oxygen, fuel, power reserve. Then, when he was completely satisfied, he spoke to Hal over the radio circuit. Though Bowman was standing by on the control deck, he would not interfere unless there was some obvious mistake or malfunction.
This is Betty. Start pumping sequence.
Pumping sequence started,
repeated Hal. At once, Poole could hear the throbbing of the pumps as precious air was sucked out of the lock chamber. Presently, the thin metal of the pod's external shell made crinkling, crackling noises. Then, after about 5 minutes, Hal reported,
"Pumping sequence concluded."
Poole made a final check of his tiny instrument panel. Everything was perfectly normal.
"Open outer door,"
he ordered. Again, Hal repeated his instructions. At any stage, Poole had only to call hold, and the computer would stop the sequence immediately. Ahead, the walls of the ship slid apart. Poole felt the pod rock briefly as the last thin traces of air rushed into space. Then he was looking out at the stars, and, as it happened, at the tiny golden disk of Saturn, still 400 million miles away.
"Commence pod ejection."
Very slowly, the rail from which the pod was hanging extended itself out through the open door until the vehicle was suspended just beyond the hull of the ship. Poole gave a half-second burst on the main jet, and the pod slid gently off the rail, becoming at last an independent vehicle pursuing its own orbit around the sun. He now had no connection with Discovery, not even a safety line. The pods seldom gave trouble, and even if he got stranded, Bowman could easily come and rescue him. Betty responded smoothly to the control. He let her drift outward for 100 feet, then checked her forward momentum and spun her around so that he was looking back at the ship. Then he began his tour of the pressure hull. His first target was a fused area about 1/2 inch across with a tiny central crater. The particle of dust that had impacted here at over 100,000 miles an hour was certainly smaller than a pinhead, and its enormous kinetic energy had vaporized it instantly. As was often the case, the crater looked as if it had been caused by an explosion from inside the ship. At these velocities, materials behaved in strange ways, and the laws of common-sense mechanics seldom applied. Poole examined the area carefully, then sprayed it with sealant from a pressurized container in the pod's general-purpose kit. The white, rubbery fluid spread over the metal skin, hiding the crater from view. The leak blew one large bubble, which burst when it was about 6 inches across, then a much smaller one, Then it subsided as the fast-setting cement did its work. He watched it intently for several minutes, but there was no further sign of activity. However, to make doubly certain, he sprayed on a second layer, then he set off toward the antenna. It took him some time to orbit Discovery's spherical pressure hull, for he never let the pod build up a speed of more than a few feet a second. He was in no hurry, and it was dangerous to move at a high velocity so near the ship. He had to keep a sharp lookout for the various sensors and instrument booms that projected from the hull at unlikely places, and he also had to be careful with his own jet blast. It could do considerable damage if it happened to hit some of the more fragile equipment. When at last he reached the long-range antenna, he surveyed the situation carefully. The big 20-foot diameter bowl appeared to be aimed directly at the sun, for the Earth was now almost in line with the solar disk. The antenna, mounting with all its orientation gear, was therefore in total darkness, hidden in the shadow of the great metal saucer. Poole had approached it from the rear. He had been careful not to go in front of the shallow parabolic reflector, lest Betty interrupt the beam and cause a momentary, but annoying, loss of contact with Earth. He could not see anything of the equipment he had come to service until he switched on the pod's spotlights and banished the shadows. Beneath that small metal plate lay the cause of the trouble. The plate was secured by four lock nuts, and as the entire AE-35 unit had been designed for easy replacement, Poole did not anticipate any problems. It was obvious, however, that he could not do the job while he remained in the space pod. Not only was it risky to maneuver so close to the delicate and even spidery framework of the antenna, but Betty's control jets could easily buckle the paper-thin reflecting surface of the big radio mirror. He would have to park the pod 20 feet away and go out in his suit. In any event, he could remove the unit much more quickly with his gloved hands than with Betty's remote manipulators. All this he reported carefully to Bowman, who double-checked every stage in the operation before it was carried out. Though this was a simple, routine job, nothing could be taken for granted in space, and no detail must be overlooked. In extravehicular activities, there was no such thing as a minor mistake. He received the okay for the procedure and parked the pod some 20 feet away from the base of the antenna support. There was no danger that it would drift off into space. Nevertheless, he clamped a manipulator hand over one of the many short sections of ladder rung strategically mounted on the outer hull. Then he checked the systems of his pressure suit and, when he was quite satisfied, bled the air out of the pod. As Betty's atmosphere hissed away into the vacuum of space, a cloud of ice crystals formed briefly around him, and the stars were momentarily dimmed. There was one more thing to do before he left the pod. He switched over from manual to remote operation, putting Betty now under control of Hal. It was a standard safety precaution, though he was still secured to Betty by an immensely strong, spring-loaded cord little thicker than cotton. Even the best safety lines had been known to fail. He would look a fool if he needed his vehicle and was unable to call it to his assistance by passing instructions to Hal. The door of the pod swung open, and he drifted slowly out into the silence of space, his safety line unreeling behind him. Take things easy. Never move quickly. Stop and think. These were the rules for extravehicular activity. If one obeyed them, there was never any trouble. He grabbed one of Betty's external handholds and removed the spare AE-35 unit from the carry pouch where it had been stowed, kangaroo fashion. He did not stop to collect any of the pod's collection of tools, most of which were not designed for use by human hands. All the adjustable wrenches and keys he was likely to need were already attached to the belt of his suit. With a gentle push, he launched himself toward the gimbaled mounting of the big dish that loomed like a giant saucer between him and the sun. His own double shadow, thrown by Betty's spotlights, danced across the convex surface in fantastic patterns as he drifted down the twin beams. But here and there, he was surprised to notice, the rear of the great radio mirror sparkled with dazzlingly brilliant pinpoints of light. He puzzled over these for the few seconds of his silent approach, then realized what they were. During the voyage, the reflector must have been penetrated many times by micrometeors. He was seeing the sunlight blazing through the tiny craters. They were all far too small to have affected the system's performance appreciably. As he was moving very slowly, he broke the gentle impact with his outstretched arm and grabbed hold of the antenna mounting before he could rebound. He quickly hooked his safety belt to the nearest attachment. That would give him something to brace against when he used his tools. Then he paused, reported the situation to Bowman, and considered his next step. There was one minor problem. He was standing, or floating,